Russia, the nuclear option, talk of treason in high places. Are we back in the 1950s? Or maybe it's just another week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. So, remind me again on what Jared Kushner does and what his qualifications are?
He's there for one reason. Donald Trump trusts him. I'm a kind of a believer in nepotism, but this pushes that beyond where I think most people are comfortable. But we'll see. I'm trying to be fair, but it's unorthodox, isn't it?
Plus, how will voters in red states react to Democratic votes on Judge Gorsuch?
Now Donnelly has another chance, and your freedom is on the line. Tell Joe Donnelly, don't let us down again. Vote to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch.
And as long as we're digging him up, is this a good time to talk about the record of President James K. Polk?
He basically increased America's territorial positioning by a third. The America that we know today and that we've had in the 20th century would not have been possible had not Polk brought the country from sea to shining sea.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 173 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Before we start off, a little housework to wrap up the week in politics. We've got results from California's 34th Congressional District, where on Tuesday, voters went to the polls to choose a successor to Javier Becerra, now the state attorney general. Assemblyman Jimmy Gomez and Los Angeles City Planning Commissioner Robert Ahn, both Democrats, advanced to a June 6th runoff. And now on to Senate races, where the first challenger to a 2018 incumbent announced his candidacy last week. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, a Democrat from West Texas, said he hopes to be the party nominee against Republican Ted Cruz next year.
All of these commitments and these opportunities, we're not going to be able to meet them, we're not going to be able to fulfill them, unless we have a senator who's working full-time for Texas.
Democrats have been saying for years that demographic changes in the Lone Star State will eventually be good news for their party. And they point to the fact that Hillary Clinton came close to carrying the state last year. But close is not the same as victory. And Democrats haven't won the state since Jimmy Carter in 1976. And no Democrat has won a Senate seat since Lloyd Benson in 1988. And Cruz, false and all, will be well-funded. We're recording this show on Wednesday, but at last count, only three Democrats, Manchin of West Virginia, Heitkamp of North Dakota, and Donnelly of Indiana, have said they will vote to confirm Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. And thus, the obvious trivia question this week is, what was the lowest number of votes that one party provided in a successful Supreme Court confirmation vote? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. It may be too strong to say that things have been spinning out of control for the White House since the healthcare failure of a couple of weeks ago, but day in and day out, the Trump administration continues to be put on the defensive. At the least, it is besieged with questions that won't go away. The latest, secret meetings in the Seychelles Islands in January between a Trump representative and a Putin ally to talk about Iran and U.S. sanctions towards Moscow. That followed a bizarre series of events involving House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes receiving classified documents on White House grounds. Everything just seems to be snowballing, which is one reason we have Carl Cannon on the program. Carl's the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics and a former White House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun and National Journal. Carl, it's great having you on the Political Junkie.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, I'm trying to figure out where to start. It seems like it's one thing after another, but maybe explain the Seychelles story.
Yeah. Look,
lots of luck with that, right?
Well, take a step back. You know, what Donald Trump has started out with no honeymoon whatsoever, and poll numbers that you kind of expect to see on an unpopular outgoing president, not an incoming president. You know, a guy who's had scandals, who's had problems, who's managed a bad economy, who's had a war he started that he couldn't finish, things like this, a hurricane that he, you know, flew over. Is this starting to ring a bell? You know, things like this. This guy comes in and it starts right away with him. And one of the storyline that he has not been able to shake is that the Russian regime of Vladimir Putin was fooling around in DNC emails and leaking stuff, giving stuff to WikiLeaks, and fooling around in the election process itself. Not, you know, tampering with voting machines. I mean, not the kind of, you know, fraud. We do that ourselves.
Right, like Chicago, right.
Yeah, Cook County, you know. And so they've been able to take this line. And the president hasn't done anything to make people think it's all in the Democrats' minds. These things keep coming out. His son-in-law meets with the Russians. You know, Michael Flynn, the national security choices, lieutenant general who didn't last very long, he meets with him and then fibs about it. Jeff Sessions is asked about, during his confirmation hearing by Al Franken, would you investigate this? Franken, Sessions volunteers, well, I never met with anybody. He wasn't even asked. Turns out he met with the Russian ambassador. Nothing wrong with that, but, you know, that's what ambassador's supposed to do. But he volunteered that he hadn't met with anybody, and he was a big Trump surrogate. So you have this background where it sort of sounds crazy, but everything that happens, you know, these guys are kind of acting guilty. You know, I used to cover courts, Ken. People act guilty all the time for crimes they didn't do. The cops don't know why, but prosecutors usually nail them, you know. And then you have this latest thing where they're talking, you know, it's two surrogates, but they're talking about sanctions, you know, they're talking about things that shouldn't be discussed by private people. That it's a back channel communication. And, you know, in its own, you know, it sounds a little bit like it could be innocent. It could be the kind of conversations that happen. It does not tie directly to Trump, but it comes in this context where you start to wonder if there's something there.
And then when you every time the president is asked about this, rather than saying, well, we should get to the bottom of it, he'll blame the Democrats. He'll blame the, you know, the crooked and lying news media. And whenever something like that happens, one wonders, well, maybe there is a there if he's so willing to just, you know, move on to something else.
Look, I don't, you know, it's hard for me to get in Donald Trump's mind. I've never covered a candidate like him or a president like him.
There's never been a candidate like that.
He doesn't come out of politics, but he doesn't like being criticized. Look, I've covered all these thin, thin guys, you know, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. Look, Reagan was an exception. He didn't mind. But even in this rarefied atmosphere of thin-skinned people, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump stands out. He simply lashes out at people who criticize him, and he doesn't address the criticism. And some, you know, that old phrase, the best defense is a good offense, that works up to a point. But at some point, the voters start to think, well, wait a minute. Why can't he just address this directly? I mean, you know, you've been a reporter a long time. Can I hear these guys think? And you think, what should he be saying? I find myself thinking, what should he be saying? But, you know, what I'd like to hear as an American citizen is the president say, look, this town is very partisan. And I tend to think that this whole line of inquiries is motivated by partisanship. But what did Thomas Jefferson say? We're all Federalists. We're all Republicans now. On this subject, can't be Democrats and Republicans. We need to find out what the Russians are up to. And I'd like to have a select committee, and here's who I'd like to head it, and I'll stay out of it. But he doesn't say that, as you point out. He just doesn't say those kinds of things.
And then when you talk about, like, we should get to the bottom of it and not be partisan, you have Devin Nunes and the House Intelligence Committee where, by all accounts, or by most accounts, perception is reality in Washington, and I understand that, but the perception is that Nunes is doing what he can to protect the president. He goes on White House grounds, gets some classified information, doesn't tell the ranking Democrats or even the rest of his committee. So what faith does the American people have in a House committee so-called investigating it when you have a Republican ostensibly in cahoots with the president?
Yeah, I agree with that, Ken. I have to tell you, Devin Nunes has a reputation, though, and his reputation is just very nice, earnest guy. That's his, you know, at least until now, right? And I think he thinks that Adam Schiff has been playing him a little bit, that Schiff's got this winning manner that he comes across as nonpartisan, but he's in fact hyperpartisan. This is Nunes's perception, I'm thinking. And this stuff comes to his attention. And so he doesn't want to, you know, give Schiff more ammunition to go on TV and be passive aggressive. I'm giving the best case now for Nunes. But I still don't get it, because he gets this call. Hey, look, we've got this stuff. The NSA picked up this stuff. They're not supposed to spy on Americans. When they do, they're supposed to hide the information. Not only did they not hide the information, they gave it to Susan Rice, who's a well-known leaker and partisan herself, who lied about Benghazi and blah, blah, blah. Even that, give them their best scenario. What I don't understand, maybe you do, I don't. He needs to go to Schiff anyway. He needs to tell Adam Schiff, he says, look, I got this thing. We got to go to the White House. I'm inviting you to come with me. Schiff would have done that. And I need you to look at this, and we've got to figure out if this means anything or not. It would have made him look good. Instead, I mean, who's winning this PR battle now between Nunes and Schiff now? It doesn't look like it's on the up and up. I don't want to ascribe bad motives to Nunes. I don't know that he's really just trying to protect Trump. But the least you can say, he acted not in a very savvy way, and he acted like he was over his head. And that's not exactly give you confidence for the head of the committee.
What do you think is going on with Secretary of State Jared Kushner?
Trick question, buddy.
I know, but I mean, my goodness. I mean, the things the White House has him doing, there's a guy named, well, let me just check it. We have to look this up. Rex Tillerson.
Yeah, that's him. I mean, that's the actual Secretary of State.
What is, I mean, where is Kushner? I mean, I know where he gets his the permission from, but what's his qualifications and what's his... What's he doing?
I mean, you know, I was watching Trump today at his press conference. He's with the King of Jordan. He's in the Rose Garden, a beautiful spring day in Washington. I thought, what if Trump solved the Middle East crisis? Would we all have to revise our view of him? You know, he's up there speaking, you know, sort of his third grade, you know, lingo. The world, I inherited a mess. The world's a mess. But, you know, we've had really smart, committed people. They haven't made any headway. I found myself wondering if this could somehow work. The Kushner thing, though, he's there for one reason. Donald Trump trusts him. And the only thing I've ever seen quite like it, and I was a little kid, was John F. Kennedy had Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General. Bobby Kennedy wasn't qualified for that job in any real way, but except one way. The president trusts him completely. But then you start to think of what, you know, compare Bobby Kennedy to Jared Kushner. Kennedy, he was older and he had a hell of a lot more experience.
He also had a Senate confirmation vote.
Right. And so I'm a kind of a believer in nepotism, but, you know, my dad worked at the San Jose Mercury News. They sent him to Washington. I worked at the San Jose Mercury News. They sent me to Washington. Now, all right, it was a different company by then and 20 years later, but still, I kind of like the idea. But this pushes that beyond, you know, where I think most people are comfortable, but we'll see. I'm trying to be fair and not prejudge these people, but it's unorthodox, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, you sound like you're being twisted into a pretzel, but I do know exactly what you're doing. You know, we're recording this on Wednesday, and because, you know, the Neil Gorsuch nomination, the vote is expected Friday, and the most likely the Republicans don't get to 60. They employ the nuclear option, blah, blah, blah. But here's my question, though. Back in 2013, when Harry Reid used the nuclear option for everyone below the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell said the move would backfire on the Democrats. Now, assuming that the nuclear option is now going to be used for the Supreme Court nominees, can you make the case that, well, let me ask you the question, does one party win or lose if McConnell changes the rules, or do both parties win in some strange way?
Well, if Mitch McConnell has to use the tactic that Harry Reid introduced to get his Gorsuch through, it will have backfired on the Democrats, at least in the short run. I think if I was a Democrat, Ken, I'd be more worried about something else, and it's this. This seat here, it was the Scalia seat, and the Supreme Court isn't supposed to be like, that. You know, it's not supposed to be a super legislature where you put your own people in. But it's been that way for a long time, and I think it's an unfortunate development, but it's reality. So if you replace Scalia with Neil Gorsuch, it doesn't appear that it will change the balance of this court, which was
a push.
Yeah, and it's a very balanced court, and you know, O'Connor and then Tony Kennedy, you know, in some cases John Roberts, you know, these two or three people who are willing to think outside their parameters decide all these cases. But if Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, or Breyer, one of these other people, or Tony Kennedy, these are people who are not young. If Trump gets another seat or two, and the Democrats force this issue on Gorsuch, they won't be able to stop these other things. And I just think, I think it's a tactical mistake. To my mind, Gorsuch was perfectly legitimate. I mean, these languages that Nancy Pelosi used, outside the mainstream extreme, well, that's not true. He's right in the, you know, he's right there where she's not a Republican, but if she was, she'd recognize Neil Gorsuch as a bright and decent guy and kind of right in the mainstream of Republican thinking. And so, to me, you let this go through, and then you say, but we'll fight it. We'll go to the mattresses for the next one because we don't want a liberal judge to be replaced with a person like Gorsuch. But if they force this issue and McConnell does this thing, they'll have nothing left to stop the next one or the next one. And I think that could be a mistake, and they could regret it. And they're being led by their base, by these, you know, these liberal activists. But I think those people are going to be the most upset with the way this comes out if the Democrats aren't careful.
But here's two things. Here's two thoughts. First of all, one, how much of this is a byproduct of what Merrick Garland went through last year? And two, even if they don't get rid of the nuclear option now, but the Democrats want to go to the mat for example, for a Ruth Bader Ginsburg successor, what would keep McConnell from, you know, using the nuclear option then?
Nothing. But McConnell is under no obligation to be reasonable at that point. Look, I'm talking about how he's thinking, if the Democrats aren't reasonable with this thing. If you're Mitch McConnell, here's what you know. Chuck Schumer voted to confirm General Mattis at defense, and I think Tillerson or one other person, I can't remember, the national security team, Chuck Schumer did, went home. 4,000 activists came to his house and told him, you know, demand, you know, resist now. We won't stand for this. Don't fight these people. You know, Trump's not the real president, whatever. He comes back to Washington. He starts voting against all these cabinet members, including Mitch McConnell's wife, who is not only an American Asian American woman, but probably the most overqualified transportation secretary, well, certainly since Norm Mineta, maybe ever. So if you're McConnell, you're thinking, okay, there's no dealing with this guy. He didn't want a deal. He's just listening to his base, and that's the way it is. And I'm just going to have to, you know, steamroll him when I can. So I think that if you take yourself out of the running of reasonableness, if you won't deal, then they don't have to deal with you. And that's the problem. But the point you made, Merrick Garland, to me this is a principle argument, and some of the Democratic senators have made it. What Mitch McConnell did last year, what the Senate did, was aconstitutional, unsustainable, that it would just absolutely beyond the pale to say we're going to wait a year to appoint a judge when next election. Now, half those Republicans who did that thought Hillary Clinton would win. It wouldn't have mattered, but she didn't. And so now it matters. And that what they did to Merrick Garland, you can't excuse it or defend it, in my opinion. I think if you want to say, and Elizabeth Warren has said it, other people said this, it's principle, I'm just not voting for any Republican because what they did to Merrick Garland, okay. But then what? You only have 8 judges on the Supreme Court, then 7? How far are you going to take that? You know, it's a problem. And also from the Republican standpoint, it didn't start with Merrick Garland. It started with Robert Bork, and it gets a little bit like, you know, trying to untangle, you know, the Middle East, right? Or Serbia. Remember when the Serbs are talking about some battle that happened in 735? I'm making up that number. The Battle of Kosovo. No American had ever heard of, and suddenly we're in NATO planes or bombing Serbia because these guys remember the Battle of Kosovo. So, you know, you can keep going back to the next one. The Merrick Garland thing just last year, certainly the Democrats have a right to be angry over it, but they need to think strategically.
Let me give you have one final thought. I mean, there's so many things to talk about, so many things going on, but on Tuesday of this week, after we learned that the Assad regime in Syria used chemical weapons against their own in their own country, Trump released a statement that read, and let me just read this in part, "These heinous actions by the Bashar al-Assad regime are a consequence of the past administration's weakness and irresolution." So in other words, he can't even get through a sentence criticizing Assad without blaming Obama.
It's so disheartening to see a sitting president do that. Trump wanted this job. He knew about Syria when he ran. Nothing's happened. First of all, he shouldn't have been surprised by that. Secondly, blaming Barack Obama is just irrelevant, even if you think what he said is true. And a lot of Democrats do, most of the Republicans. But what's that got to do with it? What are you going to do now? He was asked this at the press conference on Wednesday, and he just sort of repeated how outraged he was and then said, well, but I'm not going to tell anybody what I'm going to do. So I don't know if I'm Assad, if I'm watching that, should I be scared? Maybe. This commander-in-chief is, control over a pretty powerful military. And the other hand, I think, well, Trump didn't say anything. He doesn't know what to do either. And so I just think if you're not going to say what you're going to do, you shouldn't criticize your predecessor. What's the utility of that, and how does that help?
Carlo, thinking back to everything we've talked about today, why am I more depressed now than I was a few minutes ago?
Wait, you're blaming me? You're blaming the victim.
No, I'm blaming the past administration's weakness and irresolution. Carl Cannon is the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. Carl, it was so great having you on the program.
Well, Ken, thank you for asking me.
And before you go, you mentioned your dad, Lou Cannon, the great Washington Post columnist and the author of Reagan books. How is your dad doing?
He's good. He and I gave a talk at the Reagan Library last week, and he couldn't help it because we're comparing, people are asking him questions, the audience comparing Trump to Reagan, and I think his guy looks better every day.
Carl, thanks so much.
Okay.
The vote on Judge Gorsuch is expected to be an issue in several of next year's Senate races, especially involving the many Democrats who are seeking re-election in states that went big for Trump. We decided to take a look at two of those Democrats, Joe Donnelly, who said he was voting yes on Gorsuch, seeking a second term in Indiana, and John Tester, who announced a no vote on Gorsuch, running for a third term in Montana. Let's start in the Hoosier State with Brian Howie, a leading expert on Indiana politics, whose musings can be found at howiepolitics.com. Brian, it's great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Yeah, always a joy to be with you, Ken.
Thank you, Brian. As of press time, Joe Donnelly is one of just three Democrats who have said they'll vote for Gorsuch's confirmation. Let me play a little piece of tape from the senator.
This isn't about I get the only pick, that I get to personally pick the Supreme Court justice. I deal with the individual who is put before us. And my job as a senator from the state of Indiana is to reflect our state, to do my job. And when you look, he is qualified.
Brian, how are Democrats reacting to statements like that?
Well, this is an interesting state where the establishment of the party came out in full force for Hillary Clinton, and yet you had Bernie Sanders win the primary last year with 53% of the vote. So the party's kind of split. There had been some talk that if Donnelly had come out in favor of Gorsuch, he might be primaried. I don't take that seriously. He has always said that his boss are voters, and that this is kind of consistent with what he's always said. He's going to take the direction from what Hoosiers want, and this is a state where Donald Trump won with a landslide 19% plurality here. So I think he was definitely feeling that pressure.
So his announcement was not really a surprise in your view?
No, not really. I mean, I've been hearing from other Democrats who not only thought that Donnelly would side and vote yes, but they also felt that he was reflecting, what Hoosiers wanted. And I think that there's really little surprise in Democratic circles about this.
You mentioned that he's under a lot of pressure. Let me play an ad directed at Donnelly from the NRA.
Joe Donnelly talks a good game on gun rights.
I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment.
But Donnelly voted for Barack Obama's gun control. Now Donnelly has another chance, and your freedom is on the line. Tell Joe Donnelly, don't let us down again. Vote to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch.
Brian, don't you get the sense that Republicans are going to hit him as a liberal no matter how he votes on Gorsuch?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Luke Messer, the fifth-ranking Republican who's about ready to get into this race, he had put Donnelly on notice that he was going to you know, make the Supreme Court nominee an issue. But there are a lot of other issues, you know, from carbon taxing to the Clean Power Plan that they're going to take out against Donnelly in 2018. So they're not going to lack the issues. Donnelly's position, though, is he's been moderately conservative. You know, his kind of Democratic leadership has been reflective of others like Evan Bayh who have been successful in this state. So I think he may have inoculated himself a little bit with this particular vote.
I know, you know, Evan Bayh is certainly not a Birch Bayh when it comes to, like, progressive policies and votes and things like that. But does a vote for Gorsuch dampen the enthusiasm for Donnelly among progressive Democrats in the state?
You know, I think that as they watch the Trump administration come out against everything from NPR to Meals on Wheels, you know, I just don't think that the 2018 election is really going to center or pivot on this particular Supreme Court vote. I mean, the president and members of Congress from the Republican delegation are giving Democrats so many reasons to get involved. The Democratic chairman, John Zodi, told me that Democrats are coming out of the woodwork, interested in legislative and congressional races in 2018. So again, I think both sides are going to have a lot of issues. I think the Obamacare repeal, for instance, is going to be another one. Donnelly has already won two elections after voting for the ACA in 2010. There's going to be plenty of issues for both sides in this state.
You mentioned that Donnelly has won two elections since 2010. When he was elected for the Senate in 2012, let me play a bit of tape from his Republican opponent back then, Richard Murdoch, during their debate when Murdoch was talking about abortion.
I struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize life is that gift from God. And I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
God intended rape to happen, according to Richard Murdoch. Was the race over right then?
I actually thought that even without Murdoch saying that, Donnelly had a fairly decent chance of pulling that out. I mean, we had been polling in that race, and I think the poll right before that in October of that year had Donnelly up by 3%. You know, we thought that he had a path to win that. When Murdoch said that, though, that basically sealed the deal. I mean, the bottom dropped out for him. Joe Donnelly has been very much in sync with the voters. He has done this tour across the state where he takes on jobs. I've seen him dressed as a firefighter and on an assembly line. He was doing Meals on Wheels the other day. This guy gets it. He's been all over the state, and he really has the pulse of the Hoosier people.
Who on the Republican side is running or thinking of running in 2018?
We may have another member-on-member. In 2016, we had Todd Young going against Marlon Stutzman from the Freedom Caucus. This time, we got Luke Messer, who's in the district that used to be represented by Vice President Pence, and David McIntosh from Club for Growth. And then you've got Todd Rokita, who's on the Budget Committee. They look like they're going to get in. We've got a state senator named Mike Delf, who's kind of more from the social conservative wing of the party. He's going to look at it, and a couple of businessmen that don't really have a high profile. So it's going to be a crowded primary and possibly a member-on-member. So that's going to be a fascinating showdown.
When you think of Donnelly winning in 2012, part of it was because Murdoch beat Dick Lugar, the Republican senator, in the primary, and the Republicans were split. But in this case, do you envision that no matter who wins the Republican primary, the party will be united behind that nominee?
I think so. But Donnelly is going to go after the independents, the people that may be fed up with a lot of the things they're seeing from President Trump. I can see this midterm, even here in Indiana, being a referendum on the White House here. Obviously, the White House has Mike Pence, that they can come back in. This is going to be a very competitive race. I think it's a toss-up, but I think it could go either way. And Donnelly has shown that he can survive even in a red state like Indiana.
You mentioned earlier that Trump won Indiana by 19 points. Is he still popular in the state?
My sense is that he is. I haven't seen any recent polling. We're not going to poll this year. But on the ground, anecdotally, I hear a lot of people saying things like, well, let's give him a chance. And, you know, they're not big fans of us in the media. But I have to tell you, you know, just like any place else, you know, when you're independent voters, you still need them to win. Trump got a lot of blue-collar union voters in the state. Those are the folks that are going to shift. I think the true believers are still with him. I wouldn't expect him in a poll here in Indiana to be up 19%, though.
Brian Howie is a recognized expert on Indiana politics, and his stuff can be found at Howie Politics, H-O-W-E-Y. That's howiepolitics.com. Brian, thanks so much for being on the program.
Anytime, Ken.
God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, the life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you. God only knows what I'd be.
And now to Montana, which Donald Trump won by more than 20 points. John Tester was first elected to the Senate in 2006 when he successfully attacked his opponent, GOP incumbent Conrad Burns, for his connections to disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. He was narrowly reelected 6 years later, even though Mitt Romney easily carried the state. Mike Dennison is the chief political reporter for MT Television Network, based in Helena, and before that, a 23-year veteran of covering politics from Montana newspapers. Mike, thanks for being on the program.
A pleasure. Glad to be here.
Well, we have a solid red state. There's pressure on Tester to vote yes on Gorsuch, and he says no.
Yeah, that was on Sunday night. He spoke with a bunch of reporters, about six of us, including me, and told us that he's not only voting no, but he's going to support the filibuster of the nomination. And this is something that there'd been a lot of pressure on him from conservative groups and business groups, Republicans, people who want to defeat him next year, saying, where is he going to be on Gorsuch? And he just said, oh, I'll take my time. And then he came out and said no.
Well, you know, you look at some of the Democrats. I mean, there are only three Democrats as of now, and it probably will only be three Democrats who will vote yes on Gorsuch. But when you think of them, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota and Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Joe Donnelly in Indiana, a lot of people thought that Tester may be the fourth guy, given that how well Trump did in Montana and how conservative that state has become. But no, Tester says no.
You know, before the announcement, I was kind of speculating. I thought, I think he might go with Gorsuch. But afterwards, after he said no, the more I thought about it, the more it really made sense to me. Because, you know, the people who were attacking him and needling him and saying, you've got to support Gorsuch and spending money against him, even if he says, yeah, I will support Gorsuch, they're still going to attack him and still going to be against him during the election next year. And the people who are going to support him, Planned Parenthoods of the world, the environmental community, just the whole Democratic base, they were on his side before. Now they're really on his side, and they're really going to help him get reelected. So I think it really did kind of make political sense when you stand back and kind of take a look at it.
You know, as you were, you can't see this on the radio, but as you were just saying that, I was shaking my head in agreement, because whether he voted yes on Gorsuch, you know, the Republicans and the conservatives will come after him as a liberal. And you talked about the kind of pressure he's under. I know the NRA is running the same kind of TV commercial we heard earlier against Senator Donnelly in Indiana. But there's also another commercial, this one by the Concerned Veterans for America.
Judge Gorsuch will defend the freedoms we fought for. The Supreme Court justice Americans deserve. Tell Senator John Tester to protect our rights. Confirm Gorsuch now.
That group, Concerned Veterans for America, I don't know a lot about them, but my recollection is that they're kind of a Republican group, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're certainly conservative, and they're kind of people who I assume would support the Republican nominee in the fall anyway. But do you get a sense that the Gorsuch vote will be an issue in 2018?
Oh, I think so. I think they'll use that to hammer away at him, because in Montana, you know, a lot of the mainline business groups came out in favor of Gorsuch. You know, Montana Chamber of Commerce, the natural resource industries, leading Republicans in the state all said, he's our guy. He's a great pick for the court. So yeah, I think it will definitely be one of the issues in the campaign.
Here's a question that I don't know if you can answer, but how does Tester keep winning in a state as conservative as Montana?
You know, that's a very good question. You think back about his career in the state, And you know, that's one of the things that kind of marks him as an extraordinary politician. In those two races you mentioned, in 2006, barely beating a Republican incumbent, pretty tough job. In 2012, millions of dollars spent against him, running against our sitting congressman at the time, Danny Rehberg. Everyone thought that Rehberg was a pretty good chance to win. Tester pulls it out again. And I think that the reason I think he is able to do that is, number one, you know, Tester is a very likable guy. I mean, even if you disagree with him politically, it's hard not to like John Tester. And also, you know, he works hard on a lot of fronts, you know, for the state. He's been in the corner of veterans a lot. There's a lot of veterans in Montana. And I don't think he's really out there on environmentalism. He's a pretty big economic populist. And on health care, he stood up for the Affordable Care Act. And I think one thing that Montana voters appreciate is that if you take a position and state what it is, they respect that. If you try to duck and cover and try to be all things to all people and try to kind of shade where you are, I don't think they like that. So I think that he's always been very upfront about where he stands on things, and I think that's appreciated by voters.
You mentioned that in 2012 he beat Danny Rehberg, the congressman, and Montana only has one member of the House as an at-large seat. In 2018, the expectation that he was going to run against Congressman Ryan Zinke, but then Trump picked Zinke as his interior secretary. Did that unsettle Montana Republicans' plans for the Senate race?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Congressman Zinke was gearing up to run against Tester, and which would have been a very competitive race. So now Republicans have to find someone else who has some stature to run against him. And here it is, April, you know, Rehberg in 2011, almost 2 years before the election, announced he was running and was up and running. There were ads right at this time, 6 years ago. There were already ads on TV in that race. Now the Republicans don't even have a candidate, and I don't think they're really going to have one until probably June, you know, after a special election to replace Zinke. So they're already kind of starting out behind the eight ball.
Does Zinke becoming Interior Secretary absolutely take him out of the Senate race? In other words, could he serve in the cabinet for a year or so and say, okay, I want to come home and run for the Senate? You don't see that happening?
I don't. I'd be really surprised if that happened. I've heard no one suggest that. I've not spoken to Zinke directly, but I've kind of heard second, third hand that he's made clear that he's not going to do that.
Have you heard the names of some possible Republican candidates?
Oh, yes. The two candidates that everyone thinks of first are the Attorney General, Tim Fox, and also the new state auditor, who is our insurance commissioner, Matt Rosendale. Rosendale ran for Congress in 2014, lost in the primary to Zinke and some others, Of course, Fox is in the middle of his second term as Attorney General. And I've talked to people for both of those candidates in the last week or so, and they both kind of said, well, we're not really actively doing anything. We're just kind of waiting to see how things look after the special election. I think all of the energy politically in Montana is either at the legislature, which is still in session, or going into the special election, which happens in 7 weeks.
Well, the 2006 election was close. The 2012 election was close. No matter who the Republicans put up in next year, do we expect the 2018 Senate race to be close as well?
Yeah, I would expect so. It depends on the candidate, of course, how good the Republican candidate is. But if it's a talented, credible candidate, I think you can expect a close race. You know, Montana in his statewide races, the Republicans did quite well in 2016, losing only the governor's race. And when Democrats do win, lately at least, it's usually been by fairly narrow margins.
And we expect the same for next year.
Yeah, I would.
Mike Dennison is the chief political reporter for MTN News. Mike, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken. I enjoyed it.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, since World War II, what Republican president saw the biggest loss in House seats in the midterm election 2 years into his first term? The answer, Ronald Reagan. In 1982, with the economy hurting and Reagan's numbers sinking, the GOP lost 26 House seats that year. The randomly selected winner is Patricia Sager Limbacher of St. Paul, Minnesota. Patricia wins the coveted political junkie button. And I have a confession to make. Last week's scuttlebutton puzzle, which featured a button of Donald Trump surrounded by a wall, one that read, "Protect human life and vote for Ronald Reagan for president," and one that read, "Don't let them amenitize the Eschaton," well, it was complete nonsense. It made no sense whatsoever. Fortunately, several people figured it out, since it was, after all, released on April 1st. So, yes, another one of those hysterically funny April Fool's jokes. Alice Heller of Boston, Massachusetts knew it, and she's this week's Scuttlebutton winner. We'll have a new Scuttlebutton puzzle, for real, up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
We don't get fooled again. Don't get fooled again. No, no.
Let's be honest. It's a pain every time you're about to move. It's worse when you're forced to move several times. And I'm sure it's even worse if you have to move a bunch of times and you've been dead for 167 years. That's what's happening and is happening again to James K. Polk, the 11th President of the United States. He's been dead since 1849, but he's been interred in three different places since and is about to be moved once more. On Monday, the Tennessee State Senate passed a bill that called for the bodies of Polk and his wife Sarah to be dug up from the grounds of the state capitol in Nashville, where they've been for 124 years. They would then be relocated to the Polk family home and museum in Columbia. The move has upset Polk's descendants. Teresa Ellum, a seventh-generation niece of Polk's, said, quote, "It's like taking a soldier out of Arlington and burying him behind the barn." But what does this all mean to Robert Mary? Mary's a longtime journalist who spent years at the Wall Street Journal and Congressional Quarterly. He's the new editor of the American Conservative magazine. We had him on the Political Junkie 2 years ago to talk about his book, where he rates presidential candidates. But he's also the author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War, and The Conquest of the American Continent. So if anyone had an opinion about James K. Polk, I figured it would be Robert W. Mary. He joins us now, and we'll see if I'm right. Bob, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Ken, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, Bob. It's been written that James Polk was the most successful one-term president in our history. Now, I would suspect that much of our audience out there knows very little, if nothing, about number 11. Tell me about James Polk.
Well, Polk was a highly consequential president. He entered the office with four goals, all very, very ambitious. He wanted to get California from Mexico, which was quite audacious, and he probably knew that that was going to entail a war or a great threat of war. He wanted to get Oregon Territory from the Brits. It was actually jointly occupied. That entailed some diplomacy that came very close to war. He wanted to create an independent treasury, it was called, which is a forerunner to the Fed, and he wanted to cut tariff rates. And he did all those things in 4 years, and then he, as he had promised to do when he got the nomination, he drifted off back to Tennessee and promptly died. I think he, frankly, worked himself to death. He was a workaholic, not a particularly sympathetic figure, but extremely dedicated to work and to his goals, as we can see from his presidency.
But even before you get to his presidency, when the Democrats met in 1844, ballot one, ballot two, ballot seven, there was no mention of Polk at all. I mean, he was a true dark horse.
He was the original American dark horse. And that was kind of his life. He was always in the shadow of his great mentor, Andrew Jackson, who loved him and whom he loved. He didn't have the outsized personality of a Jackson. He had a small-sized personality. He was a rather drab of temperament. But by golly, he was relentless, and clever and wily. He politically positioned himself to be the dark horse. Failing that, he was hoping, although things weren't really going very well, that perhaps he might get the vice presidential nod. You see, the problem with Polk is that he spent 14 years in Congress. He was chairman of Ways and Means. He was very prominent in Congress.
He was a Speaker of the House, right?
He was Speaker of the House. And then he goes and he runs for governor of Tennessee, two-year term. Didn't really want to do it. He liked Washington. He was doing well. Nice constitutional position he had. But they wanted him to because the Democratic Party was beginning to falter in Tennessee, and they needed someone of stature. So he ran, and then he ran for re-election 2 years later, and he got knocked off by a guy named Lean Jimmy Jones, who was a bit of a prankster and a kind of a cartoonish character. And Polk was, of course, very serious and drab of demeanor, and Lean Jimmy just ran rings around him. And Lean Jimmy won. So Polk basically said, I got to get that seat back or my political career is pretty much over. So he ran against Lean Jimmy 2 years later, and Lean Jimmy won again. So he was a two-term loser. Everyone thought his career was over. He calculated that the best way of getting back into the game was to cadge the vice presidential nod, probably with Martin Van Buren. But Martin Van Buren wasn't giving him much in the way of positive signals, but he's continued to, in his relentless way, position himself. And sure enough, when the convention deadlocked, they turned to Polk, and with a great deal of enthusiasm, I must say.
So you talk about how drab and dull Polk is, and yet in the 1844 race, he beat Henry Clay. I mean, that was before he changed his name to Henry Ali. But Henry Clay, I'm sorry, I know. But I mean, he was a political giant. So how does somebody drab and dreary beat a giant like Henry Clay?
By being brilliant, and he was brilliant, and he knew how to position himself on the issues. I'll just take one example, and that is the tariff race. He wanted to reduce tariff rates, but he had to get Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania, of course, was an industrial nation, and they wanted protectionism. So he had to sort of craft a middle ground. And so he said, well, I'm in favor of reduced tariffs generally. I want tariffs to be where they need to be for the economical running of the government. But within that, I'm perfectly happy to accept protective tariffs for industries that may need it on a temporary or on a isolated basis. And that was just enough sort of calibrate the vote of Pennsylvania, and he carried Pennsylvania, and that's one big reason why he managed to beat Henry Clay.
One of the few things I know about Polk is that in his 4 years as president, the geographical status of the United States grew enormously. He expanded U.S. territory with the acquisition of Oregon, and I mean, he did that. He could have gone to war with Britain over that, right? But there was no war.
He came very close. Just to show what he did do in terms of territorial aggrandizement, I'll see if I can sort of name the states. He brought in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, part of Montana, part of Wyoming, part of Colorado. Then he brought in Texas, California, New Mexico, Arizona. I'm missing something. Nevada. He basically increased America's territorial positioning by a third. And that's a huge number of square miles.
And also the U.S. now had a presence in two oceans, right?
Two oceans, poised to dominate the world, really. I mean, the America that we know today and that we've had in the 20th century would not have been possible had not Polk basically brought the country from sea to shining sea.
Now, I mentioned that, or you mentioned as well, that he got the Oregon Territory without going to war, but he did go to war with Mexico over California. How popular was that war?
Well, it was popular enough initially because he maneuvered America into that war in a way that brought a lot of patriotic fervor, as there always is patriotic fervor in the beginning of a war. But the war dragged on. It lasted more than 2 years, and a war that doesn't seem to have an end in just dragging on and the president can't get out of it, as we know from Vietnam and we know a little bit from Iraq, can be pretty enervating to a political party and to a president. And that's what happened to James Polk.
Well, I was going to say that in the modern days, I mean, the wars you just mentioned, you know, we heard allegations about lying to get us into the wars. Lyndon Johnson and the Bay of Pigs for Vietnam, George W. Bush and the weapons of mass destruction with Iraq. Was Polk honest about the reasons for going to war with Mexico?
He got a big rap for lying to the American people. And he has a lot of detractors among historians today. And he still gets that rap. I think it's a little bit of a bum rap. There's no question that he maneuvered America into that war and that he wasn't totally forthcoming with the American people in terms of what were the events that led to the confrontation in which, by the way, I think 11 Americans were killed. I think maybe 11 or 12. I can't quite remember the number now. And so he went to the American people and he said, and to the Congress, and he said, they have spilled American blood, shed American blood on the American soil. Well, it wasn't exactly American soil, although that's a debatable matter, perhaps. It was disputed soil. But he got his war, and then Mexico basically said, we're never going to give up. And Polk thought if he sort of sent an army a couple hundred miles into Mexico, they'd sue for peace. Well, they didn't sue for peace. We went all the way to Mexico City. We planted the American flag on their most hallowed municipal and governmental buildings. And finally, they did sue for peace, and we ended up paying for, but we ended up getting all that territory in the Southwest that I mentioned, including California.
Where was he on the issue of slavery?
Well, he was a slave owner, and he was a traditional Southern guy, so he was a defender of slavery. I think it would have to be said that he didn't have much of a moral imagination when it comes to the slavery issue. And, of course, he lived in a different time from ours, but even within the context of that time, he lacked a sensitivity to the implications of slavery, which a lot of even Southern statesmen held.
Do you think he could have won a second term, had he run?
Questionable, because he expended a huge amount of political capital. He was a man of boldness, and the war and his other initiatives sapped a lot of his political standing. And, of course, the Whigs won the presidency after his four-year term, and so I would say that it's kind of a question on the cusp. He might have won a second term, but he had expended an awful lot of political standing in behalf of his big, bold agenda, and it generated a lot of controversy.
Where do you stand on the issue of where to bury him?
Oh, well, I come to praise him, not to bury him, but I was going to say
Khrushchev promised to bury us, but nobody expected Polk to be buried four times, right?
Yeah, no, four times is a bit much. You know, it's funny. I'm just pleased that he's not being moved because he was a slave owner or because he, you know, took us to war in Mexico or some of this stuff that's now going on with regard to some of the great statesmen of our past, even though they were on the wrong side of history. But I will say that poor Polk in death gets buffeted quite a bit, just like he did in life. He was always struggling with petty matters that he took umbrage at on the part of the people around him. He didn't have a very robust outlook on the world. He was crimped and suspicious. And maybe if you're saying, well, who would he be like? Well, I think maybe not in terms of his full character, but in terms of his temperament, maybe a little bit like Richard Nixon. He was very prickly.
Bob Murray is the author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War and the Conquest of the American Continent. He also wrote Where They Stand, which I think is a lot of fun. It's a book that rates all the presidents, good and bad. Bob, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Always a pleasure, Ken. Thank you very much.
If I was to fight, would you fight against me? If I was to run, would you run with me? If I was to die, would you bury me deep? Say you would please.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content, including past episodes of the show, and to subscribe to our newly redesigned weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.